can't believe all the people questioning my educational policies at Wolf Excellence Charter School. Didn't they see the video where I let the ninth graders out of the bamboo cage so they could say how happy they are? Look what this blogger wrote. Dr. Wolf's so-called successes are based on manipulation of numbers and a tyrannical leadership style. I have got to tweet back at that. Hey, you fat jerk, how about I roll down there and kick you upside your empty head? Now here's some parents group saying I drove low-performance students out of the school using blowguns and poison-tipped darts. I hope you're wearing a protective cup, you losers, because here comes a fastball of education truth aimed right at your particulars. Can't they see why I'm the most trusted name in education reform based on purification through pain? Why don't they just... that's the kids in isolation block 16 escaping. Trying to escape. I gotta go. Today on the show, The Nose talks about how the nation changed after Dallas, plus the tweets of Dr. Steve Perry, the jokes of Jennifer Bosworth, and the case of Michael Skakel. And now, the strict father who wouldn't let his daughter date Charles Manson, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I don't know if you're up to the speed on that one. We won't be discussing it today, but a 25-year-old devotee named Star, the name that Charles Manson bestowed on her, has plans to marry the infamous serial killer, according to a new profile in Rolling Stone. I told my daughter, he's 79, you're 25. It's just, you know, think how old he's going to be when you're 50.
A profile of her in Rolling Stone or
no,
of him?
Of him.
Of Manson.
So it's the Charles Manson profile you've been longing for. Anyway, we're not talking about that. And despite what you heard on the promo, we're also not talking about Monty Python. That was just a whim that was just, you know, we don't always know in the first 24 or 36 hours.
We're not.
Well, we're going to talk about that on those. Well, we could, but we probably won't. All right. So joining us today, author and critic Rand Cooper from Patty McQueen Communications. Was that the right name?
No.
Patty McQueen Strategies?
No.
Patty
you
McQueen.
Know what? I'm not telling you.
All right. From Patty McQueen Lingerie and Fine Cuisine.
Yeah. That's it.
Patty McQueen. Yeah. And from Trinity College Professor Irene Papoulos. That's who's here with us. We hope you're with us, too, and that you want to join the conversation as we go along. I don't know why I would give you the phone number now because we haven't said anything, but 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR. Colin, our tweet master, Greg Hill, is, I think, in the house and tweeting back at you from WNPR. Colin. So that's how that works. We're going to begin. Well, actually, I should say what we'll do in the second segment. In the second segment, we will talk about the case of Michael Skakel, free on bail for the first time in more than a decade as of yesterday. Oh, I think a $1.2 million bail. Also, we'll talk about the story of – was alluded to in the introduction, Dr. Steve Perry, a very controversial sometimes divisive education reformer here in Hartford, but with a national reputation. He's kind of gotten in a little bit of trouble with his fiery tweets. And fiery tweets are the worst thing to have them treated topically. And so it's fiery tweets. And then we're going to go to Jennifer Bosworth, fiery in her own way, a former Connecticut journalist, now difficult to say exactly what her role is with the Back Nine Network, but for some reason or other, the Back Nine Network, which is a Hartford-based cable golf network that has received more than $5 million in state funds, felt very embarrassed by kind of a comedy routine that she did on their website. Anyway, we'll get to all of that. But we're going to begin with the Kennedy assassination. I mean, you've heard a lot of coverage today. It made us pause for a moment anyway about whether we should talk about it too. But it is the, you know, we're all sort of shaped by it. We're all of an age where we are shaped by it to a certain degree. And Rand Cooper had directed my attention to an essay by Adam Gopnik, which was printed a couple of weeks ago in The New Yorker. And like many Adam Gopnik essays, it's not the easiest one to sort of pull out a single topic sentence. It's not an easy thing to summarize.
That's kind.
Which is why I'm going to have Rand do it. No, Rand, it seems as though what Gopnik is saying is getting at in this essay, and we'll be sharing some quotes from it and things like that. But it seems like what he's getting at is that something changed as a result of the assassination, and then the incredibly kind of murky rollout of competing theories about what actually happened. That something in the American spirit changed, but what? I think that's sort of basically the question the essay asks.
Mm-hmm. I think in a way the essay is an attempt to address a commonplace of Kennedy assassination commentary, and that has to do with this notion of a lost innocence. Somewhere in one of the newspapers, there were brief accounts of various public figures. Where were you when Kennedy was killed? And Tom Brokaw was a young news editor out in Nebraska, somewhere in the Midwest, and he recalls what happened that day. And then he ends with this this short statement, I lost my innocence that day. There's a strange way in which individuals have sort of taken over this cultural, social commonplace about lost innocence. And I think what Gopnik's essay is trying to do in part is to delve into – it does two things. One, it addresses and assesses from a skeptical point of view the merits of the case for believing in a conspiracy of multiple shooters and so on, all the conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination. And then, two, it addresses this nature of what it might be by way of innocence that was lost. I just want to say one thing about that. I think he doesn't make this point, but there's a sort of baby boom, a potentially monstrous baby boom demographic input into this notion of innocence. I was 4 years old. I was in nursery school, what we used to call nursery school at the time. All I remember is that my cartoons the next day were canceled. But there's a way in which baby boomers, who were all children then, it's very easy for them to conflate their own personal passage from childhood and the sort of Edenic loss of innocence stories that accrue in that category, you know, with this event. So there is this kind of way in which, oh, well, it's very convenient. Now, this mammoth number of baby boomers are all really sort of narcissistically referring to their own childhood and their passage from it.
But, yeah, but can I just say something about that? Speaking of autism, so I'm a little older than you, so I remember it maybe a little bit more clearly than you do. You know, my mother crying and that whole, and Walter Cronkite and all those details. But I was talking to a historian recently who said, and we were talking about that idea of innocence, you know, that sort of feeling like the country used to be innocent up to this point and it wasn't. And this historian said, well, you know, that innocent sense was really associated with the 50s. You know, it wasn't really, the country wasn't as innocent before that. And it was also associated with a certain demographic, you know, like, so the middle class, you know, mainly white people, who Americans, who felt like, you know, we can always get better. We have progress. You know, there's justice in the world. Things are good. You know, things are going to get even better. It's a small world after all. If you remember the World's Fair, those of us who are a little older than Rand might have gone to the World's Fair.
I do
Fair.
Remember the World's Fair.
Oh, okay.
1964. Right?
Well, yeah, you were
so
still.
He was five.
I was five years old.
Like you remember
me,
it?
Yeah.
It's a small world after all,
those
right?
Those Belgian waffles.
Those and the cars and everything is just going to get better. And so it's the baby boomers. And so I think younger people have a hard time understanding that sort of nostalgia for that particular moment in history because they don't feel it in the same way.
But so first of all, I need to say that you guys were even able to read that essay. I mean, I feel really stupid because I like read it and I don't, you know, I was sort of lost because it seems to me.
Well, it begins with a fairly obscure reference to Shelley.
I mean,
the first sentence of the
That's not the only obscure thing in it, but
it's very much an English major's essay.
But at any rate, it seems to me, I was, you know, 4 or 5, and I remember it vividly because my friend who I'd come home on the school bus with called me from her house to tell me, and we turned on our TV, and I was devastated. And I don't think this was that complicated. I mean, this was a vibrant, alive, you know, family that was completely destroyed in front of us. There's no way to look at anything that happened to Jackie Kennedy that day and see anything but utter and complete devastation of a human being by having this her husband literally exploded in front of her. And I don't think, it seems to me that's so traumatic as a nation and to those, you know, individually to those of us that it mattered to, that this isn't that complicated.
Well, that's certainly true, and that trauma, as many have pointed out, was this was one of the first major news events that was covered largely in visual media, and so that lent a different kind of immediacy that amplified that sense of trauma. But I think Gopnik is making a different point, and if I could sum it up, I would say something like this. He assesses the conspiracy theory skeptically and says he, in effect, dismisses them. But he tries to get at the cultural and political underpinnings of these conspiracy theories, and he locates their plausibility in the fact and the revelation of a sort of semi-secret world where presidents and gangsters and mistresses and spies and the military run amok or might run amok. which the typical citizen of the time was kept innocent of, not in the least by the active collusion of the press, who saw it as their job, in stark contradistinction to what it subsequently became, as one of cleaning up things so that people could have a sort of sanitized and purified version of how the world works. And so Gopnik writes that, and I'm just going to quote one passage, "To dive into the assassination literature 50 years on is to find two truths overlaid. The first truth is that the evidence that the American security services gathered within the first hours and weeks and months to persuade the world of the sole guilt of Oswald remains formidable. The second truth of the assassination is that the security services collecting that evidence were themselves up to their armpits in sinister behavior, even conspiring with some of the worst people in the world to kill the presidents of other countries. The accepted division of American life into two orders, an official one of rectitude, a seedy lower order of crime, collapses under scrutiny like the alibi in a classic film noir." And I think most of his essay, and I agree that that's stylistically more complicated than it has to be, but you know, he's making the point that a lot of the reality of American life was kept secret from us. And we were given a sort of official, cleaned-up, white-bread version of how politics and governance worked and how exemplary American leaders lived their lives, so that all of American life came in retrospect to seem like a conspiracy in certain ways to cover up the truth. In that way, he says, you know, whether this was an actual conspiracy to kill Kennedy doesn't really matter, because in that way, conspiracy became a sort of metaphor for how the reality of American life was hidden. And in the decades since then, we have relentlessly uncovered so much wrongdoing.
Now it's just so much, so intrinsic to our view of everything.
And I think that's one of the reasons that I would dispute that it's a simple story, or it's an uncomplicated story, as you said, Patty. I mean, even just to quote again from Gopnik, I mean, even to the point of this vibrant family torn apart. They were a vibrant family, but as Gopnik says, the case of Judith Campbell Exner is famous. She really was JFK's mistress and a Sinatra girlfriend and the mistress of the Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana, all within a few years. Even if she wasn't exactly, it wasn't actually a go-between from one to the other, that would not alter the reality that she had slept with all three and so lived in worlds that, in 1963, no one would have quite believed could penetrate each other so easily. Still more startling is the case of the painter Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was also unquestionably one of Kennedy's mistresses. She was the ex-wife of a high-ranking CIA officer who himself had once had pacifist leanings, an intimate of Timothy Leary at Harvard, and an LSD user. She was murdered in 1964, he goes on. I mean, this vibrant, happy family concealed, you know, all kinds of dark strands. I just want to make one other point, and then I'll throw it back to you guys. Just as the Irene's original point, I think this is the most important thing inside Gopnik's essay, at least to me. And I think, you know, everybody can extract kind of what they need or what they want. I don't think this was the death of American innocence, but I think it was the death of something similar to what Irene was talking about. In a way, it was kind of the death of American rationalism, or to use the more contemporary phrase, the reality-based community, which was a term that was used supposedly disparagingly by a George W. Bush Confederate, probably Karl Rove.
It was, you know, Karl Rove.
Yeah, I think it's we now know it to be Karl Rove. But you know, going into the Kennedy assassination, there was a post-war boom. I don't think this was an innocent place at all. I don't think there was any innocence to die. In fact, I think one of the books that really gets this well, oddly enough, is Stephen King's 11/22/63, where he just talks about this, the incredible, you know, evil and hatred simmering in Dallas, in Louisiana, and all these places that Oswald would go. I mean, it was not an innocent place. But what it was a very hopeful place about reason and science and technology. And there was this kind of sense that, particularly in the post-war time when there were things like, you know, gas chromatography and mass spectrography, and we could understand things better and better and better, that it was possible in the sort of really dyed-in-the-wool American tradition of Enlightenment reason to understand things. And so here was this thing that the nation desperately needed to understand, absolutely needed some consensus on, the most important thing in the world. Somebody killed the president. And with every possible forensic technique and scientific means brought to bear on it, all we wound up was more confused, you know, more confused than ever, to a point where now, you know, reasonable people may differ. I mean, it's, a lot of people are lone gunmen people. John Kerry, the Secretary of State, announced this past week that he thinks it was a conspiracy.
But really? when I say it's a simple story, what I'm saying is that I think it's simpler than a 2,000-word essay that And actually, I think that what you just laid out is more simple than what was laid out in that essay is kind of what I'm getting at. And I also think that when I talk about a loss of innocence, it's about, you know, learning that people are lying to you about things. I mean, just as basic as the president's head was half blown off, and yet they brought him to the hospital and they held us all in, is he or isn't he not dead, when on the spot the Secret Service agent said he's not, and everybody knew that he wasn't on the spot. So I'm not disputing that there are complex layers of this. It's just that I'm not sure that it requires psychoanalysis to understand it as much as understanding that people gave us explanations that whitewashed a lot of things, that we learned that people in charge don't tell us everything.
But in that sense, that's sort of – you were just citing Gopnik's point about that people right. in charge really don't tell us things. You know, I mean – and maybe that is – maybe that's one of the fallouts.
He quotes Norman Mailer from Presidential Papers, which was published right around the same the month Kennedy died, referring to a fissure in the national psyche, a divide between the passionate inner life of America and its conformist – repressed official life. Quote, the life of politics and the life of myth had diverged too far. And I think, you know, to learn that people aren't telling you the truth is a jolt whenever it happens to you, whether it happens to you in your personal life or whether it happens to you politically. In the 50 years since Kennedy died, our default assumptions as a society about who is likely to be telling us the truth and who isn't have changed radically. Now, all sorts of skullduggery went on well before Kennedy was assassinated, and if you look back at the retrospectoscope at the 1950s, you know, you see the American government was certainly up to all sorts of nefarious stuff abroad. But you know what? We didn't know much about it. We didn't suspect much about it. Polls consistently show that people instinctively trusted their politicians, their government. Think of all the stuff that's come out in the last, you know, 50 years. Medical experimentation on syphilitic African Americans, drug LSD experiments conducted on unknowing people by the government, assassination attempts on foreign leaders, you know, from Castro to Allende to Lumumba, complicity in coups, Watergate, of course, brazen corporate dumping of toxic chemicals in the Third World.
Isn't it amazing how when you just state the facts, you sound like a Don DeLillo character?
Right, but Bhopal. I mean, we have come to expect that we live in a tangled web of dark, covert actions about which we will be routinely and systematically lied to. This was not the case. It may have been the case in actuality, but that wasn't the mindset of people 50 years ago.
Yeah, but I feel like the place where, you know, psychoanalysis might come in a little bit maybe is the idea that we still, in spite of all that, in spite of all that we know, in spite of even, you know, any 10-year-old knows those things or at least knows the concept of those things, you know, that the government isn't honest and all that, we have this yearning for it not to be true, you know, like for somebody to tell us what's really going on. And I mean, which I think is a good yearning, you know, and we don't want to collapse into cynicism because we couldn't really function that way. If we really didn't believe that there was any, you know, truth or anyone telling us the truth or anyone that was really looking out for our best interest, I don't know how we could live, you know.
Well, that's what marriage is for.
I mean, you know, I think also, I mean, one of the things that I object to do about the Gopnik essay, and by the way, if you want to call in about this, and Larry from Middlefield will take you in just a second, our number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Gopnik kind of makes the argument. In fact, I'll read the part of it. He sort of talks about conspiracy theories and yeah, well, I'll read the whole thing. He says, the paradox is that just as Thomas Pynchon and Don DeLillo dramatize a paranoia with texture of specificity, the paranoid types are in their own way often much more empirically minded, willing to follow the evidence where it leaves, even if that is right through the looking glass, than their more cautious confreres. It is, in other words, possible to construct an intricate scenario that is both cautiously inferential, richly detailed on its own terms, complete, and yet utterly delusional. The JFK conspiracy theorists are the first and hardiest of those movements, the truthers, the birthers, the moonwalkers being their stepchildren. And see, I don't think so. I don't think that's right. If you go into a room of, you know, 10 relatively well-adjusted people who are, you know, partaking of society on more or less normal terms. And you say that you think the official explanation of 9/11 is a hoax, or that we didn't really land on the moon, it was all done at a soundstage, or that President Obama was, you know, born in Indonesia or Africa or wherever he's supposed to have been born. Most people are going to look at you like you're nuts. I mean, you are going to be regarded as a crank. Whereas, I mean, a conspiracy explanation for the Kennedy assassination is, if anything, pretty normative. In fact, in the 90s, I did an article about sort of single gunman theorists and how unfashionable they felt.
How lonely they felt. Like no one would talk to them at cocktail parties.
Yeah, and particularly when the Oliver Stone movie came out, it was so unhip to believe the official version. You know, it was sort of – it was an unattractive, boring thing to think. And I think it's that rare thing. At minimum, it is a question about which reasonable people, as they say, may differ. And I would say even more than that, you know, believing in – some kind of conspiracy is rather than making you a pariah, kind of makes you seem like, you know, you've been really thinking about this.
Because you're looking for the truth, because you believe in truth and you believe that we need to get to the bottom of it.
Well, yes, but...
And with you know, maybe there's just enough evidence.
But all conspiracy theorists, having spent a lot of time around 9/11 truthers, I can tell you that all conspiracy theorists believe that they are looking for the truth and that other people are not.
Right. And what becomes wearying about the attempt to look for the truth, I mean, if you're skeptical of these things, is that you realize at a certain point, we all have, for whatever mysterious reason, some built-in disposition, predisposition, either to entertain these kinds of beliefs or not to. We're sort of intrinsically, inherently skeptical and resistant to them, or we are toward the other end and avidly welcome them. Personally, myself, I'm very resistant to them. I've spent a fair amount of time at various times looking into the details either of various Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories or certainly of the 9/11 stuff.
And then have you done that if you're resistant?
Because I want to know what they have to say. I'm sort of interested in, you know, my enemy in a way.
So it's not because you think you might be able to find an answer.
Well, you want to sort of know, right, like, what's their best argument? Like, what are they referring to? And you want to know, because you're curious, how does the mind work, you know, that believes that there was some sort of conspiracy, you know, other than the obvious one to you know, destroy the World Trade Centers. But what happens after a certain point is you spend X number of hours looking into this and you think, you know what, no, you certainly are never going to be persuaded, nor are you ever going to persuade anyone who holds these beliefs that they're inaccurate or irrational. And then I simply immediately sign off, because I think people are just expressing whatever this inbuilt predisposition one way or another is, and it's not really about rational argument. It's about that disposition.
Right. And, you know, there's also I feel like I've read – for a while I was just obsessed with it. I read everything I could read.
Kennedy.
Yes. I mean, I read Death of a President. I read – which is, you know, talk about a slog just to get through that, and all of those details and on and on and on. And all about the conspiracies. And honestly, I don't know. But what I am struck by is that 50 years later, we don't know. And I really believe that if there were that big a conspiracy, that somebody would have talked by now in a way that was more credible than an Oliver Stone movie.
So what do you think propelled you to read all those?
You know, I was obsessed with the Kennedys and, you know, Caroline and John and Macaroni and everything before the assassination. So for me, it was this
Macaroni?
Sort of the pony.
Yeah, pony.
Pony. And I was devastated. And I remember watching a whole funeral whole weekend and the horse with the boot the wrong way. And
you were
obsessed.
Only five.
Yeah, I was obsessed.
I understand that motivation, but there's another one. And that is, given the list of stuff that I read earlier, sinister, bad stuff that actually happens, a part of you can't help but think, well, what if it's true? What if it's true that this sinister...
You're not the kind of person that's predisposed
to believe. Yes, I am, because if that's a 5% possibility, it's still, I might be 95% stoutly disbelieving. But if there's a 5% possibility, well, then my worldview is going to need major readjustment. That's unsettling, and it's sort of simultaneously repulsive to me, but also, you know, you feel like you have to do due diligence.
Let me grab a couple of calls here, then we do have to wrap this up, unfortunately. We could talk all day about it, but that's in the nature of that beast. Here's Larry in Middlefield. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hey. How are you?
Okay.
Well, look, I was around 12 or 13 when the assassination took place. And I got to tell you, I think part of what you miss is that Kennedy was in Texas because he wasn't popular at the time or as popular. His popularity was below 50%. He'd been elected by the popular vote of about 1%. And he was down there trying to screw up votes so that they could maintain, so they'd be sure to take Texas.
This is actually something we did sort of share a little bit in the emails is the number of people who, I think you were the one who was emailing about this, right? The number of people who reacted to this with sort of good.
There was a terrific piece, and I've read so much about the Kennedys in the past 2 weeks that I can't remember what it was, but it was about the changes in Dallas in the past 50 years and what a better place it is now. For instance, the chief of police is, I think, an African-American woman and so on. But the writer was a young person in Dallas at the time, and he recalled just how casually acceptable open, blank hatred of Kennedys, of liberals, of Northerners, of Northeasterners was among even, the wealthy upper middle classes in the country.
Wade Goodwin also talked about this very eloquently on Morning Edition this morning. All right, we got to stop or we won't have time for all the other stuff that we're really interested in. So we'll stop, we'll take a break, we'll come back. All right, we're back. We're with Rand Cooper, Patty McQueen, and Irene Papoulos. It's The Nose. We love to have you converse with us, too, 860-275-7266, even though I only managed to get one call into the conversation last segment. But okay, so we're going to go from there. It's a semi-smooth segue to the story of Michael Skakel, who has spent more than a decade in prison after being placed on trial as an adult for a crime he is accused of committing as a 15-year-old, the murder of his 15-year-old neighbor in Greenwich, Connecticut, Martha Moxley. He was sentenced to 20 years to life, and yesterday he was released on bail after having been granted a new trial by a Connecticut judge who said he received ineffective assistance of counsel from his defense lawyer in the first trial, Mickey Sherman. But the thing that makes it a smooth segue, Patty McQueen, is that, of course, there's a Kennedy connection. He is the son of the brother of Ethel Kennedy. So I don't know. I'm just going to hand it off to you. And let you do what does this story say to you? First of all, does it strike you as a Kennedy story, or is it?
Well, first of all, I don't think that anybody would have paid any attention to this story had it not been Kennedy cousin Michael Skakel. And I also don't think he'd be out of jail right now if there hadn't been the Kennedy money behind him to get him out and to spend the money on all these other experts. You know, and it strikes me that the real loser yesterday was Martha Moxley's mother. I mean, your heart just breaks for this woman who's for all these years tried to get some justice for her daughter who was killed as a teenager and now this. And I think she's been graceful and lovely about it and there's just this circus atmosphere about this story from the beginning that I'm not sure how she's survived it. And it strikes me that all gets lost in Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy in this. And I'm not sure, you just wonder if you're ever going to know what really happened.
I would agree. I agree with a lot of what you said, although one bracket I would put on this is also to say, and I do want to hear what the other people have to say, but I think you're right about all of the things that wouldn't have happened if there weren't for the Kennedy's connection and all of the money. On the other hand, I also feel as though he wouldn't have been placed on trial if it weren't for those things either. The history of prosecutors taking up a case that old and also placing on trial as an adult a person who is alleged to have committed a crime at the age of 15. And people who commit crimes at the age of 15 are not typically tried as adults and then punished as adults. This is a very unusual case, and it was revived partly because of Dominic Dunham and Mark Furman and a lot of people who were attracted by the luster and the aura of this case and the Kennedy connection and the wealth. I don't think the case would have been revived and reanimated, without that. So, yeah, in some ways, Skakel has obviously benefited to a certain degree degree from the incredible wealth and connections of his family. But I don't think he'd be on trial if it weren't for that either. I just don't think that would happen.
I don't think and find me a story. You know, do a Google search. There's probably no story that doesn't include the words Kennedy cousin in front of Skakel.
Rand, what were you going to say about this?
Well, I agree with what you said. Nothing I have to say about this is based in anything other than a bunch of sort of half-baked notions that I have as a consumer of stories about. I mean, there's a weird thing that happens. You follow a trial. You're reading these accounts of the trial. And you inevitably sort of act as judge and jury and come really ridiculously to some sort of judgment yourself about whether the person is guilty and innocent or innocent. I happen to have an abiding intuition that Skakel did not do this. I think I was swayed in part by the article that his cousin Robert Kennedy Jr. wrote, I believe it was in The Atlantic, in which this is maybe 8 or 10 years ago, Colin. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
And in which he meticulously addressed problems in the case that were made against his cousin. Now, obviously, he was hardly an impartial commentator on this, but I found it persuasive. But I agree, Colin, that your comment about the likelihood that this never would have been brought up. Look, Americans have a very ambivalent relationship, understanding of the proper fate of celebrity when in a courtroom. And it's not simply that wealthy and famous people have always been able to buy their way out of things. To some extent, it's true that occurs. And yet Americans, the American public can also turn on its celebrities and be quite vindictive. So, you know, a movie star is shoplifting or something. Suddenly people want her scalp. Hollywood studios had to hide the real lives of their stars for many, many years for fear of a moralistic, vindictive reaction from the public. I suspect that something like that was in play, aided, abetted, and used by ambitious prosecutors. So I agree, Colin, this never would have been brought. But certainly if he hadn't had, as we know, borrowed hundreds of thousands, used hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars of his own money, and then borrowed hundreds of thousands of dollars from siblings and cousins, certainly this would not be happening now. You need resources to hire the people that he's hired and go digging.
And I want to hear from Irene about this. So there's a central irony in the fact that one of the few people who's been able to get a new trial based on ineffective assistance is somebody who had millions and millions of dollars to spend on his assistant. Think of all the poor people who have an overburdened public defender. Think of all the people sitting in prison right now who can't make that argument, because you have to have a lot of money to make that argument, to hire Hubie Santos to do a great job making that argument about you. But Irene, we're going to have to speed date through this.
Well,
you'll get the last word.
That's why I feel skeptical about his innocence, even though it does the evidence does seem to point there. You know, but the whole thing about us tearing out our hair because we don't know the real answer is the connection to me with the Kennedy story too. Reasonable people, you know, can sort of see it both ways, and that's really vexing. And who was that other Kennedy brother that clearly did do it, you know, and had that long trial? I can't remember.
William Kennedy Smith.
And just seemed like he did do it. So, but anyway,
All right. So we have to speed date forward. All right.
The other piece of this is the Mickey Sherman piece, which I sort of fascinates me. That talk about a trajectory, you know, a bell curve into.
Mickey Sherman was the defense lawyer, a very sort of colorful, media friendly. Some would say media. voracious lawyer who,
in all of this court proceeding, he's sort of responsible for all of this new badness with getting the new trial, and he's just been it's a new low, I think, for Mickey Sherman.
All right, we have to move on because we're going to try to get through two more topics before we go to the break and do our endorsements afterwards. Steve Perry, who is the chief administrator of Capital Prep in Hartford, but also a national figure in the school reform movement, has become increasingly more controversial. We're going to just play a little clip of Steve Perry recently on Where We Live. This is, I think, in response to a caller named Nate, who asked him how he could be a good administrator when spending lots of school time on Twitter. By the way, Dr. Perry has actually done almost 32,000 tweets since starting his Twitter account. And he also spends a lot of time on the speaking circuit while pulling down a six-figure salary as a school administrator in Hartford, making a lot of money as a lecturer. Here's how the clip goes.
African-American children at Capital Prep outperform many of the suburban children in places like Greenwich. So your question, if you dare ask a question about how we perform as opposed to your personal issues with me, but you try to find out is, how come more schools are not doing what we do? Well, I have days off, and I take those days off. And because I take those days off, to get out and speak on behalf of children as opposed to making up excuses as to why children cannot be educated. I understand that there are some people whose comfort level is made to feel low. But that's your problem. I'm here for children. I am not here to make grown people who have pensions on the line feel comfortable. I am here because I know that every single child in the United States of America needs an equal education, not just the education that you feel these children deserve.
Wait. Okay, so hours after the Harvard Board of Education voted down a proposal that would have allowed Dr. Perry and his Capital Prep Magnet School model to take over another troubled Hartford school, he tweeted the following. The only way to lose a fight is to stop fighting. All this did was piss me off. It's so on. Strap up. There will be head injuries. The chairman of the Hartford School Board, Matt Poland, who'd been a backer, actually, of Dr. Steve Perry's, called for an investigation based on this crypto-violent-sounding tweet. So, Rand, you're sort of you've got a kid in the Hartford schools, and you follow a lot of these education debates. I don't know. Boil this one down for us from your perspective.
Here's how I would boil it down. There's an ongoing debate about the nature and merits of school reform, in particular the extent to which it's appropriate to allow outside entities to run urban public schools. So specifically charter schools and then schools like Capital Prep that are Hartford public schools but have a good deal more autonomy both in their labor relations and the way they structure curriculum, classes, and so on. There is a growing body of very vocal anti-reformers who believe that school reform, with its emphasis on testing and on freedom from dealing with unions under traditional restraints, really amounts to a quote-unquote corporatization of public education and whether it's brazenly an attempt to bust teacher unions. So this is already a raging fire, this debate. Steve Perry is a can of gasoline who is applied to a raging political and educational debate. So we can certainly talk about him, the merits of his tweet, and so on. But the real point out there right now is Hartford's seeking a new superintendent. Hartford only has a couple of charter schools. It has its brand of school reform, relies on magnet schools, and does not use a lot of outside entities. This Capital Prep, you know, was one of them, was going to take over one of the schools, and you know, that's been nixed.
I'll pass it off. I'll pass it down the line. I have my thoughts about this. I'll chime in at the end, maybe.
And I would say, just to complete that thought, Rand, is that I don't think that Perry speaks for all of education reform. You know, at least you hope that he doesn't, because there has to be some kind of a middle ground in this. And for him to kind of suggest, you know, one of the quotes that I saw of him, heard of him defending this was that, you know, I'm worried about kids and you're talking about my tweets. Well, we're talking about your words.
And
that
he's
you
made
broadcast.
It about his tweets. He is a tweeting machine.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Jonathan Pelto has done a lot of blog posts in which he just lists all of Perry's tweets for a day. It's amazing how much time he spends doing this.
And the other thing that I would say, just sort of gratuitously, is that interview with John Dankosky was, as a listener, was one of the more amazing pieces of radio that I've heard in a long time. And I'm not, you know, I was sort of yelling at my radio while I was listening to it, and I am in awe of John Dankosky over that. I really am.
It was great radio.
It was.
All right.
I'm going to go to WNPR and listen to it when I get home. But I guess I would say, as somebody whose sympathies are with what Rand called the anti-reform reformers, you know, I think that word reform is always in quotes, you know, and that so many people in education can use that language, reform, you know, get rid of failing teachers. What exactly is a failing teacher, and who defines it? You know, that's a very tricky question. I care about children. Of course, we all care about children. You know, that's not really the point. But it's interesting how they appropriate the language of things that we all believe in and turn it to nefarious ends.
I just, my reaction to all this is that school reform at its worst is a political movement dressed up as an education reform movement. And Steve Perry is the absolute embodiment of that. I mean, this is a guy who basically is a political figure pretending to be a school principal. And his arguments are primarily political. From what I can tell, just looking at some of the critiques of him, looking at some of the actual numbers, he's about 80% smoke and mirrors and about 20% substance. And what I'm really astonished by is that going into this debate and into this vote that ultimately triggered this inflammatory tweet, he had the support of Mayor Pedro Segarra and Matt Pullen, the chairman of the board. They actually thought he was pretty good. And I don't understand how that can be. I mean, I think when you look at how he comports himself, when you look at some of the claims that he makes and how they either hold up or don't hold up to scrutiny, this guy raises so many red flags. I'm amazed he's come as far as he has. And I'm amazed he had as much traction in Hartford.
Well, the red flags are obvious from, you know, his behavior, and all you have to do is listen to him. And he certainly is in some ways the most ambitious and careerist of all the people in the Hartford public school system. And he's been on CNN and he's written books and so on. But people of raging ambition often do good things. And so I haven't – I mean, the claim that the storyline of the school is that we've taken a bunch of inner city exclusively – mostly African-American minority kids, and we've gotten them to college at rates that so far exceed any other school like ours that it's quite remarkable. So that's the storyline of the school. Now, I haven't looked at, you know, in the fine print to see how much of that is smoke and mirrors, so I can't really speak to that.
Well,
but that is why you would believe in him.
The counterargument, just very quickly. First of all, there was several astonishing moments on that show that Patty's talking about, including one where a caller came up and called up and said, well, only 20 out of a class of 66 actually graduate. And he did not dispute that number.
Because it's attrition, it said in that other article.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a blog.
It's a lot of attrition.
There's a blogger called Jersey Jazzman, who's some kind of education guy in New Jersey, who's been looking a lot at Perry and Perry's numbers. First of all, the analysis that I've seen suggests that Perry can't really claim that he's educating the same group of people that a typical Hartford school, you know, 10 blocks from his would be educating. That it's already a pretty cherry-picked school population.
Well, they go through the same lottery. They go through the magnet lottery, I believe.
Still,
it's a magnet school.
Still, this guy has numbers on how many people speak English fluently, how many people are eligible for assisted school lunches, stuff like that. Perry's numbers were way, way lower. It really is a different population. And then, of course, if you're really good at driving out some of the people who will mess up your numbers and getting rid of them year by year by year, you can make your numbers look even better. So I'm suspicious of this guy and his numbers. And I think a lot of people are.
For anyone out there who wants to read the most vocal, articulate, and comprehensive critic of school reform, it's certainly Diane Ravitch. Mm-hmm. Her books are celebrated. They're well known. She's just had one come out recently. I think it has a title like
Reign of Error.
Reign of Error. The hoax of school reform.
She and Perry are in open warfare.
Right. Now, I believe her fundamental critique of school reform is excellent. She constantly reminds you that we cannot expect schools to solve problems that are political and socioeconomic problems that are created by our politics. But she has become, interestingly, a more and more extreme critic, not only of the actuality of school reform, but even of the motives of the people who go into it. But I think she goes too far. But she is definitely someone you have to read if you're interested in this issue.
All right. We have to take a break. Come back for endorsements after this.
That's what she said, that's what she said. She tried to pull her heart out, my dumb side that is bad. That's what she said,
that's what she said,
that's what she said.
Strap up, you big ball of fluff. I'm loaded for bear and there will be flesh wounds. Do you think Oprah might take that the wrong way? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me with help from our interns, Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ethan Hawke. Greg Hill tweets our show at WNPR Colin. For photos, stories, links, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff wearing tight halter tops and tons of makeup and dishing out dating advice, check our website, WNPR.org. And now, back to Colin.
Actually, that last joke was a reference to something we thought we would get to, which were the comic videos of Jennifer Bosworth. But we're not going to talk about that because we didn't have enough time. Instead, we're going to do our endorsements. So, Patty, you go first.
Oh, God.
Or do you not
I'll do it. I'll do it. I'm saying that because I took your earlier email very seriously that we needed to sort of make them much more personal. So I have one sort of silly one and the other is imagined. So the first one is that I've gotten obsessed with this ridiculous Twitter, whatever, cute emergency. They tweet these pictures of cute animals and baby animals. And it's just ridiculous. But, a baby otter in a coffee cup is just more than I can handle on some days. So cute emergency was one. And the other is something that I didn't do last night that I should have. And that was go to the Elvis Costello concert. And it is making me pull out all of my old Elvis Costello CDs.
It was a tough night last night. You had the Connecticut Forum, the Andy Norell concert, which I did go to, and which was fabulous, and the Elvis Costello concert and five other things. And sometimes living in Hartford is just so damn exciting.
Right.
Irene, what have you got for us?
I'll second your endorsement of Elvis Costello, just listening to him. I've been reading this book called Foreign Gods, Inc., INC, which is a novel by a former colleague at Trinity who now teaches at Brown named O.K. Ndibe. He's from Nigeria. And it's an interesting novel about the experience of being an immigrant in the United States. And he did really well at Amherst College, the protagonist of this novel. But he can't get a job because in the corporate world that he wants, because he has a really strong accent. And so the whole idea of an accent precluding him from connecting to what he wants to do in the United States is interesting. It's really an interesting novel about the immigrant experience in the United States.
All right. Rand Cooper, what have you got for
us? I'm going to boost two superb institutions on Park Street in West Hartford. One, the Quaker Diner. I always recommend breakfast places. Fabulous hash browns, down-to-earth place, great place to go. And nearby, the Playhouse on Park. My daughter takes a theater class there, so it's a terrific place for kids. And they have a kids play this weekend called the Main Street Kids Club. So go to Playhouse on you. Seats are cheap, and you sit like 5 feet from the actors. Playhouse on Park, Main Street Kids Club. And I also want to give a quick shout-out to the Hartford Public Schools. My daughter's a second grader at one of them. We often hear about the achievement gap, how the schools are failing. In the 4 years that my daughter has been to school, every single teacher she's had has been a resourceful and excellent and dedicated person. There are people it's a magnet school, and I frequently ask people who drive their kids 20 and more miles to go to school, why from the suburbs, why are you doing it? And I always expect they're going to say, well, we love the diversity of it. A dad said to me the other day, I'm friends with a teacher at this school. She was correcting some stuff their kids were doing. I said, what grade do you teach? She said, first grade. And I looked at the stuff. I said, our kids aren't doing that in first grade. And he immediately yanked his daughter from her suburban public school, brought her into Hartford. Teachers in an urban setting have to find ways to be terrifically resourceful, and they managed to do that again and again in Hartford public schools. So kudos to them.
Just sort of on the heels of Patty and Irene's endorsement of Elvis Costello, who I also worship as well, but since also playing last night was the steel pan player Andy Norell at the University of Hartford, an amazing, amazing concert. He plays as part of a jazz quintet. It's much more jazz than it is Trinidadian music, although it's all based on the Trinidadian invention of these steel drums. And in fact, he gives a little speech about how these incredibly tough guys, these really sort of ruffians, were the people in Trinidad who discovered and started to make steel drums and figuring out how to sort of tune them and be able to produce the entire 12-tone spectrum out of them and stuff. But the music was fabulous. It makes me want to go check out some of his recorded music. But I'm also going to quickly endorse a podcast called Hang Up and Listen. I'm a sports fan, but I'm always looking for some kind of sports thing that speaks to me a little bit more, or it's a little bit more diverse, or, it just, for people who like Adam Gopnik essays, what is there in the world of sports? This podcast, which is part of Slate's menu of podcasts, slate.com, features, among other people, our own Mike Pesca, but it's sort of a different Mike Pesca even than you can hear on public radio. In the latest edition of the podcast, which I was listening to last night, he bursts into some Gilbert and Sullivan at one point, something I didn't know Mike Pesca could do. Mike Pesca's singing is not something I endorse, but the fact that he knew a sort of Gilbert and Sullivan mot juste to apply to something else that they were talking about. And in the middle of this podcast, there was a discussion of this cricket player who Indian cricket player who just retired, who I knew nothing about, but to say he's the Michael Jordan of cricket is an understatement. It's almost as if there had only ever been one basketball player that anybody cared about, and it was Michael Jordan. Then you have this cricket player. And I don't know, I just learned so much about this, and I feel like ESPN doesn't really do a good job of telling me about cricket and how it affects everything else in the world. So hang up and listen. Great podcast.
Colin, I just have to endorse Ex Post Facto. You as the narrator and Peter and the Wolf last weekend at UConn, you were great.
Thank you so much.
Well, there's still some things that can be improved on. Overall, I think so far you're doing a pretty good job. Sincerely, Kyone Wolf. Do you think that was too harsh for the Pope? God knows he can take it.